until we start treating these meganets, as I call them, in, I guess, a more ecological way, treating them more like, you know, economies, or treating them like weather systems, we aren't going to be able to figure out how to actually like make interventions in them that actually are effective, but instead we're just doing things that either don't work or annoy people, or both, usually both, it seems.
Hello everyone, my name is Stephen Parton, and you're listening to The Feedback Loop by Singularity. This week, our guest is author David Auerbach, who was a software engineer at Microsoft and Google during their rise to become the dominant companies that they are today. In this episode, David and I discuss his latest publication, Meganets, how digital forces beyond our control commandeer our daily lives and inner realities. David explains how, despite what many tend to think, the realm of digital technology we all occupy is beyond the control of any of us, even the major companies who are creating the technology. He suggests it's become a complex system that is difficult, if not impossible, to predict, and therefore impossible to control, similar to the weather. This takes us on a tour of the many consequences and benefits of this paradigm, including the loss of individuality, the impacts of ChatGPT, the loss of a shared reality, regulatory possibilities, and much more. So without further ado, everyone, please welcome to The Feedback Loop, David Auerbach. All right, well, I'm going to start with the obvious question here then, and just ask you what a Meganet is, and perhaps more importantly, why did you decide to dedicate so much of your time and energy as a thinker to write about the concept?
Yeah, and I think just as easily you could ask, why invent a new word? because there are so many new words floating around out there. Why did I think that there needed to be a new one? And I'd say that the key aspect of it is that I didn't think we had a word that really reflected the equal importance, not just of the large scale networks we have, but also of the constant effect that the hundreds of millions of users of those networks have in shaping the behavior, weights, whatever of those networks, to the extent that, you know, compared to when I worked at Microsoft and Google, we felt that we had, you know, more or less total control over our systems. And if you look at it now, we didn't predict it. And I think, and yet it's undeniable that so much of what tech companies confront these days are systems that are running of their own accord, and not because, you know, bad actors are messing with it, but just because these systems so rely on the data that users put into it on a near constant basis, and that alter the, whether you want to call it weights or algorithms or training data, that this voluminous mountain of data is itself sort of is a semi-autonomous entity that you just don't have control over as you would traditional algorithms or traditional software, where it's like, okay, we give you what we want and you like it and you complain about it and we fix it, you know, piece by piece. So Meganet, it takes into account that, the core notion of feedback, which I inherited from the cyberneticists. I don't talk about it explicitly in the book, but it's very much influenced by Norbert Wiener and Ross Ashby, and the idea that these systems are constantly responding to, constantly engaging in sort of iterative self-modifications that, you know, the designers and administrators of those systems only have, you know, indirect and partial and coarse-grained control over. And the reason why I thought this was so important was because it seemed like so many of the debates at all levels really were oriented around, I think, increasingly archaic conception of technology as being something that could be controlled at a fine grain level. Even within tech companies, I think that, you know, executives really preferred to think that yes, they could do whatever they want, even if they were choosing not to. When in actuality, these systems are considerably more out of our control than I think anyone would really like to think. And that until we start treating these meganets, as I call them, in, I guess, a more ecological way, treating them more like, you know, economies, or treating them like weather systems, we aren't going to be able to figure out how to actually like make interventions in them that actually are effective, but instead we're just doing things that either don't work or annoy people, or both, usually both, it seems.
Yeah. Well, would you say the big issues here, that you have two forces at play? You have the fact that once you put a tool out into the world, you have 8 billion people who can do whatever they want with it, and that's really hard to predict what all those people are going to do with it. And then on the other end, you have these automated tools that once you create them, the algorithms are kind of running without supervision in a sense. And that allows for this dynamic between the two that's very unpredictable. Right. Is that kind of at the core?
Yeah, it's both of it. And the fact that those are necessary, that to build these systems, there's no possibility for any sort of human administration to take place at that scale. They've just gotten too big. So it's not as though we've made this choice to outsource it to machines. It's that even if you're bringing in human moderators, human reviewers, which companies are doing, there's no way you're going to get through all the content. You're seeing this now. Yeah, obviously Facebook faced this problem, but you're seeing this with AI now too, whereas there seems to be the AI companies are pretty secretive about what their training data is. And I think it's because if you show it, if they release it, it's going to be, well, who vets this? Well, it's vetted at a coarse grained level. You're not putting in blatantly ridiculous sources. But when they say, oh, we trained it on Wikipedia, did someone go through Wikipedia and say, it's wrong there? And it's like, you know, no one's going to claim that Wikipedia is accurate, right? But are the AI companies going through and looking at it and saying, okay, we've isolated the good bits of Wikipedia and we're using them as training data? No, of course not. It's impossible. So that's what you're going through, is that you've gotten to this scale where the only, you know, who's big enough to watch the watchman, right? Well, you can only build another system. So you get into this circular dependency where you're looking to AI to solve the problems that these mega nets and the AI versions of them are creating, which is that you can't reliably administer them. But that's, you set up the circular dependency there, where it's like, okay, well, how are you going to make sure it's doing the right thing?
Are there any gears or levers or dials that we can reliably point to give us some way to nudge the MegaNet? Like, are there any leverage points that we have a good grasp on?
I mean, you can always make course level changes, you know, and the examples I like to cite here, TikTok, I think, relaxed their recommendation algorithms when they were having trouble with recommending too many pro anorexia videos to teen girls. And that gets into the idea of, okay, well, engagement has become this sort of default, goal of, well, tech companies don't really want to be in the business of telling people what they should be seeing. So the default answer is, well, we'll just give people what they want. As it turns out, giving people what they want is not always a good thing. But the question is that you don't want to be prescriptive. So I think TikTok just sort of relaxed it and was like, okay, we'll just have more heterogeneous. So that sort of coarse-grained, non-targeted intervention, I think, is manageable. And that's what I recommend in the book, as far as like, if you want to at least put some sand in the gears of these systems to at least prevent them from spiraling out of control on such a in such a fast paced way. The other example, Facebook in the run up to the 2020 election banned all political advertising. And I always cite this because it's like, okay, does this seem like the action of a company that was actually able to sort of like very carefully filter out what was true and what was misinformation. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like this was the action of a company that was like, okay, forget it. We're just going to wash our hands of the whole thing. They also limited link forwarding to, you could only forward to 5 people at a time in Messenger, which is interesting in itself in that you're now, that's truly private discourse. And they're basically just saying, we're going to limit the fan out here so that a link can't spread to more than 5 people at a time. And I'm not necessarily endorsing those specific measures, but I am saying that that's the sort of measure that you're actually going to get some traction with, as opposed to say, oh, let's get rid of misinformation on this topic, or even let's identify misinformation and put little tags on it. That, I feel, those are pretty much non-starters.
Right. Do you think some of the issue comes from what I would call a perverse incentive of attention, right? Of hijacking people's attention for engagement, for advertising? Do you think if we shifted to something like a subscriber model or had different aims for these mega nets in the beginning, that we could have the ways they manifest be more harmonious to the human condition, I guess?
Lord, that's a great hypothetical, because you're basically saying you're going way back in time and having a huge divergence. I it's weird. I personally tend to be a little actually fatalistic about it. And I bring this up when I talk about Farmville, which I don't know, you probably remember Farmville, The thing about it, it was an addictive viral game where your crops die if you don't like beg your friends to play and do all that too. And I feel that the thing is with these things is that if Zynga hadn't invented them, someone else would have. So that's not to remove responsibility from people, but there is a part of me that tends to lean towards thinking that human nature being what it is, and virality being what it is, that the only way to have gotten onto a really different track would have been to administer, an authoritarian degree of control that I couldn't imagine happening. And you can even say that, information about China can be a little hard to find, but it doesn't really seem like China has created an environment that is all so different, that they're also playing catch up and they're building out similar systems, and they have an army of sensors and monitors to try to find the people who are saying bad things, and they still can't keep on top of it either. So that's not to answer your question definitively, but I do feel like in some ways just the glut of information was just going to prove to be too much for us to handle. And it would have evolved into something along the lines of the shape that we're going in today. I do think that, the sort of the centralized mass media model, despite the continued prominence of a number of institutional outlets, CNN or Fox or whoever, I do think that it is still gradually losing traction, and that will continue, and that just because of the nature of these things and the fact that you can get these spontaneously self-organizing groups of geographically disparate people, that it's you're never going to be able to batch up attention into such centralized forms ever again, barring again some hyper authoritarian intervention.
Does that worry you in terms of access to a consensus reality? Not having a common ground between people, it seems like a kind of big social problem for a society.
We're there. I think we're already there. I think we've been going there, and I think it's only going to get worse. I think, the better aspect will be, I think people will start just ignoring realities that are opposed to theirs rather than fighting with them. And that, so things will actually seem peaceful. It's just, you won't even be aware of the fact. You'll cease even speaking the same language. I think one of the reasons for the development of, of highly sort of jargonish languages within online subcultures is to make it very easy to identify and cluster with other people. And this is on all sides. This is, you know, this isn't just like what terms wokeness, but also, there's a vocabulary that is very specific to right-wing circles, to singularity circles. There's an entire mm-hmm. vocabulary I could use here that I wouldn't dare use, it would be pointless for me to use in other interviews, you know. I can talk about rule versus act utilitarianism on this show, and it is entirely possible that a good chunk of your audience actually will know what I mean by that. I don't know, but I wouldn't necessarily bring that up on a lot of the other interviews that I've done. And, you know, if you look 50 years ago, that definitely wasn't the case then. There was much more of a shared vocabulary. So it goes beyond. So when you talk about reality, I would say, yeah, it's extending to the level of just the language being used. And Lord knows, just in doing interviews for this book, I've been amazed at just how it's interesting, because before we started, I was talking about bias, and that might have actually been the wrong word. It gets down just to the level of vocabulary and perceptions of the world. And I think one of the things I did in this book was I did try to remove myself from any particular context as much as I could. And I've been in probably, I think, a wider variety of them than a lot of people, because I was in academia, I was in like DC think tanks, I was at software companies. People have very much created shared sets of assumptions that they never think to question. And the issue is when the rubber hits the road, when society actually has to take an action that means different things to different people, what do you do about this? I think COVID was definitely one wake-up call on that, but I think it happens in a much subtler way.
So is that one of the negative consequences then of the meganets, is that they kind of build these isolating pockets by virtue of kind of algorithmically pushing people into little echo chambers?
The term I've been using is narrative bunkers, because it's not just echo chambers. You can have disagreements within them. It's just that the prioritization is the prioritization and sort of shared assumptions vary so much. I think a lot of the problem is that it comes also from the jarring juxtaposition of skill. It used to be that you dealt with the wider world only intermittently every day. You know, you'd get the news, but everything else was local. That's not true anymore. So you're constantly being reminded of A, how big the world is and how connected you are to it, while having to ignore the fact that huge chunks of it are, have completely different assumptions about, how it operates. And that sort of jarring dissonance, I do think is producing a lot of the noise and confusion we see today, because you can't go completely fatalistic and say, oh, nothing is meaningful. Some people are doing that. On the other hand, obviously, people are saying like, well, okay, now every single thing, oh, here's a person that did something I don't like and they're responsible for what's wrong with the world. That doesn't work either. But it's not something, here I'm going to say, and we evolved to perceive things in more or less small, upfront personal groups. And, you know, mental plasticity is an amazing thing, and the human brain could work out a way to do it, but it's a big challenge. If only because our bias towards centering the unit of agency on the individual person is very strong. I mean, and I think that more and more, to the extent that it ever was, I think that seeing individuals as the movers and shakers in this world is also becoming a more and more antiquated idea. Because as power devolves, individual agency, I think, does require some idea of a hierarchical society and elites. And to the extent that that is getting leveled, by MegaNets, which I genuinely do believe it is because the power is devolving, it becomes harder for to say, oh, here's an influencer, or at least an influencer past a certain point, that there will be more and less important people, but the critical mass required to really move something is going to require, I think, groups of people joining together. And I think that's why I point out that someone like Elon Musk is as much someone who's following trends as instigating them, although they like not to. Such people prefer not to be that way. But I think if you look at, like, you want two big personalities, look at Donald Trump or Elon Musk, and I think you'll find that, ironically, they were more flexible in sort of what they would say, and that anyone who sort of sticks to their guns on this or that tends to die out as their consensus, as their backing, as their group or whatever sort of evolves and shifts.
Yeah, I mean, I often think about the fact that hashtags are incredible in the sense that when a hashtag goes viral, you know what every human on the planet is basically going to be talking about that day. And it's quite remarkable that at the same time, all of the species is focused on this one conversation, because that's what you're supposed to talk about that day. And I know in the past that you've talked about, I think it was a Bitwise, the nuance being lost for the individual. So do you think people are becoming more standardized because of this, that when these MegaNets, I guess, deliver us the daily trend, that we all kind of coalesce or move towards that trend, and in that way we all kind of lose some of our individuality?
Well, very, very categorized and regimented, that, you know, you're now expected to list yourself as a bunch of labels, whether they're hashtags or identifiers, that you know, it's not that you're presenting yourself as yourself. You're presenting yourself with a laundry list of computer friendly terms by which you can be slotted and sorted. And those, because the natural tendencies of these systems are to reinforce that. Well, if you see that I like jazz, you're not going to group me with people that like, you know, country music. Well, okay. So that's going to become more and more something that's sort of pasted onto my personality. Now, my sense is that also led Facebook to decide that I was black. So, you know, it's not like these things, it did for like several years. And when I was looking over, I was like, well, maybe it's because all these jazz artists, I'm like, I don't know. But that these things are projected onto us as much as we take them onto ourselves, and they do become self-reifying. You have to actually actively work to reject them. You don't even know when they've been assigned to you. And this is just, you know, it's not as though it's not as though we don't prejudge others in a day-to-day life. It's just that now it's being reified, built up, and prescribed algorithmically nonstop. And yeah, I think it has a certain reinforcement mechanism, and it has a certain, it has a certain reductionistic aspect where these labels, because you'll be, and we can take much more, you know, loaded labels. I tried to pick music as a fairly innocuous one, although people certainly find ways to argue about that. But, you know, if you want to say whether you are, you know, all you need to say is, are you gender critical or are you trans right activist? You have already said all you need to say on that issue to at some point, you are all, you've already limited your audience. And it gets to the point where it's like, well, what's the point in speaking beyond that? Well, a lot of it is to shore up one's own sense of group identity.
Yeah. What are the implications, I guess, for you of this in terms of power dynamics then? Because I think of Social Dilemma, you know, when they had this idea of the voodoo dolls in that documentary, the idea of voodoo dolls being built for each person based on these labels you're giving yourself. And if the MegaNets are automated and they have all this information about you, it seems like there is a gross imbalance in the amount of power that the people who at least have this data have over the people who are being labeled.
Yeah, well, I mean, the good thing is that there's so much data that they can't administer it on a person-by-person basis. Mm-hmm. There's a case I talk about in China where a corrupt administrator labeled someone as, I think, under quarantine when they weren't. That actually turned into a big scandal, and the person was, I think, disciplined and sent to jail or something. So there's big pushback on that. I don't think that's power tech companies are particularly keen to have, because they want money. They don't want to actually, I genuinely don't think they actually want to have power over people. The difficulty is that this power sort of accumulates in clusters in sort of a organic way, and they're watching people get stigmatized right out under them, and it turns into chaos. So can you create systems in which that sort of stigmatizing and gang-like mentality is less likely? Well, I think if you take non-targeted steps to try to, to break up like really ossified, like ideological and affinitized clusters, you might be able to help that a bit. But there's no question that as the gaps between groups grows, they become less human. They become less human to you, and you care more about, the people that you interact with and with whom you share a common vocabulary. And it does seem like the whole idea of an objective view, a view from nowhere, has become less popular. But I do wonder how much of it is that is simply becoming, it's hard to even imagine, because there's just so much data. Now that we're producing more data every day than we did in the entire history of the world up to the year 2000.
Yeah. Do you think that is having some adverse impacts on us? Because I think of a concept called learned helplessness in psychology, where if you're constantly exposed to an adverse stimuli and you can't get away from it, you develop learned helplessness. And this is kind of like a gateway to psychopathologies like depression and complex PTSD. And it feels a little bit like this overwhelming amount of data that you're talking about here could kind of lead to that, where it's just like there's so much change happening so quickly, there's so much data, and I feel helpless. I feel like I have no control over any of it. Do you worry about that?
I think it's paradoxical, because I think there are self-correcting aspects to it, because you find people who think the same way that you do and are very allied with you. And in some way, you can find a sense of belonging that is in some ways greater than what you would find in a friends group locally, because you're going to find people who really, you can migrate towards people who really share a lot of interests with you. And I mean, it's like, there's definitely on, like, if I look on my Facebook wall, there are people who will get a certain frame of reference. And I don't think I could find enough people like that just like in the immediate vicinity. So it's this like increased sort of hyper sense of belonging fighting against the fact that you're more aware of your group being an island in a sea of mutual incomprehension. And that gets back to what I was saying about my thought that these little clusters will become more units of agency themselves. It will have more mechanisms for groups of people to act as units, and that those numbers, because numbers count at this point, that one voice in the wilderness is actually, I think, matters less than it used to. Being a contrarian, you need 50 contrarians instead of just one, because you need to, or you need a bot army and need to engineer that or something, just to sort of get enough volume and noise into the system to start making a difference. So I think what's happening is everything's sort of moving up a level. That instead of the individual, you're having these sort of these subgroups, and that they're going to start acting more as one. And And you'll at least feel a great kinship with the other people in your group. So it's a weird combination, I think, of alienation on the one hand, but also incredible belongingness on the other. And I think, well, there's pluses and minuses to that.
Well, I was going to say, like, in addition to maybe this ability to find affinity groups, what are some of the other pros? We've touched a lot here kind of on the consequences, the negatives, but what are some of the other pros that you might see in the MegaNet culture and in MegaNet dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the you know, not we talk about bad things sort of spreading virally, but the ability for information sharing is generally tons of good effects on its own. The ability to build up, you know, collective knowledge in a more concrete way than we have before. I don't think ChatGPT is conscious or anything, but just the mere fact that we've been able to dump a huge amount of human data into it and out comes something that can sort of speak with the default voice of humanity. That's a remarkable thing. And there are positive aspects of that, even if there are also negative and very conformist aspects to it as well. But I the book certainly focuses, I think, on the problems, but that's because I think it is presenting us many problems. At the same time, the ability to look up and synthesize huge amounts of data, is definitely going to lead to, knowledge work that, has not been possible before. The question, I think, is whether it's going to get drowned out by all the garbage that's being created at the same time. You can pull back and look at it as, okay, well, if you look at an environment in which you've effectively gone from informational and publication scarcity, and that basically there's just a very tight limit on what information can be created, published, and distributed because of the sheer limits of like physicality to what we now have, which is more or less informational abundance, that the bar to create, to publishing something and getting it out there, or at least making it available to anybody, is pretty much zero. What are the positive and negative effects of that? Because I think that's really the turning point. And the good is, well, everything is out there. The bad is that everything is out there and it's too much for us to deal with. So the problem has shifted. So in effect, I think the landscape has shifted and the set of problems has shifted. You know, I'm old enough to remember a time when it very much felt like there was a monopoly on information. And for all the fights that we now have about how like, oh, our viewpoint is being censored. I mean, it's not that there's not ground for complaint, but you still have much more opportunity to get out there and at least still have it be available. Even if it's more, many of the complaints are like, well, okay, I'm not being ranked highly enough. Well, okay, at least you're still there. You know, it's not that the complaint isn't legitimate. It's just that it's a very different landscape than when you literally could be shut out. You could basically be made into nothing. And, one of the things I point out, you know, so Substack, in its early days, the sort of elite consensus was that, oh, Substack is only where like apostates only right wing wackos publish on Substack. You shouldn't go there. And that thing was gradually chipped away as more and more people got on Substack. And, I will say that when I, in publicity meetings for this book, I was a little surprised at some of the suggestions that were given to me that I'm very sure would never have been made to me like 5 or 10 years ago, as far as like, oh, here's where you could promote your book. And this is old school, you know, New York publishing company. It's not saying anything bad about them. This is just, I think, a representative trend that that any attempt to sort of preserve a narrative monopoly, you can do it, but it's much leakier. And in some ways that's good. You know, I think the fact that sometimes it's good that we don't have control, you know, sometimes it's better for no one to have control than for, you know, anyone to have control, because, but it produces a certain amount of chaos and produces certain problems that we're having great trouble coming to grips with, because it seems like people are in agreement that no, total anarchy is just doesn't make for a very pleasant experience. It does seem that, like, you know, you don't have to be in favor of actually like censoring people to say like, okay, to say that, well, we should build systems in which people can have somewhat more pleasant experiences. Or at least I haven't seen many people holding up 4chan as like some ideal of internet discourse, even the hyper-liberal.
No, not at all. Do you think though that the LLMs, the like ChatGPT, do you think that they could potentially undermine their own benefit by creating so much chaos? And I guess by that I mean, if you have the feedback loop of for these mega nets, and you have the large language models pulling their data from the pool of knowledge that's out there, but the pool of knowledge is created by the large language models in ways that isn't accurate, right? It's creating just natural language that isn't actually correct. Yeah. It's just creating whatever words look good. Eventually it kind of corrupts itself, right? Is that a possibility?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, I from the very beginning, I was thinking about this, because it was like, well, okay, here's the New York Times writer saying, oh, ChatGPT says it wants to launch nukes and release the nuclear codes or whatever. And I was like, oh, great. Okay, so basically we're going to write a bunch of articles about this, which are going to get fed back into the next iteration. And it's going to talk about that much more when we ask it about AI. And so, yeah, this is going to be a big issue. But at the same time, I forget who I was talking to about this, but I was saying that on the other hand, if you lower it could actually be perversely good, because if you lower the average quality of content on the internet enough, people will lose enough faith in it that the problem sort of corrects itself, where, oh, everything is now ChatGPT generated garbage. Okay, well, great. I'll just ignore all of it. So you could actually, and the pendulum could actually end up flipping back to some sort of more authorized hierarchical form. I don't know. But that's the thing, is that it's difficult to extrapolate, because I don't think it's necessarily a one-way direction, except in terms of the sheer size. But how we react to it, I think, will continue to sort of swing back and forth in terms of, well, we'll release these things, they'll have unintended effects, and then there'll be just a counterpull in the other direction. So, you know, the LLMs, they're going to be useful for generating content in very, very strict contexts. And I think that's manageable. There's going to be enough context where it just, like, the facts aren't going to be too much of a problem and people will edit it. But in terms of auto-generating articles and auto-generating CRUD, I mean, there's a lot of that out there already, and there's going to be more of it. Yeah.
Well, it makes me think of ways to potentially certify or validate that the data is coming from a reliable source, right? And this is something that you've talked about with, like, Aadhaar, I believe it's pronounced, India's ID system. And I'm wondering, do you see something like a digital ID as like a step forward that might help improve the fidelity of a MegaNet?
I mean, I feel like there's two different issues. One is authenticating sources of content. But just because you've authenticated the source doesn't mean the content's any good, as we found out, because there are plenty of very reputable sources that are still garbage. And then on the other hand, there is just the issue of, okay, how do you describe the provenance of content, which doesn't necessarily have to be tied to an individual person. It just has to be, you have to have some sort of chain of trust established, where it's like, okay, well, this video was recorded and here's some guarantee that this video has not been doctored at some point along the way by AI, and some guarantee that it was actually recorded on real hardware. That second problem, I think, can be dealt with. I think it'll take some time to get into place, but I don't see how you, I think it's going to become necessary because you're going to need some way to tell whether like a video has been tampered with or not. And I think it's going to be difficult to do unless you've got some external validation system. As far as digital ID goes, I do think we're heading in that direction just for the sake of simplicity. I have very mixed feelings about it because centralizing identity around any single identifier. And I think it would have to be governmental ultimately, even if right now it tends to be more private. That's why I say that I think India is sort of a peek into the future in that, why wouldn't you want to unify driver's license, social security numbers, and just sort of link all these things together in a more robust way? Well, for privacy reasons, for things like that. But those arguments, I do think, are unfortunately going to fall by the wayside in favor of just like basically you have all these multiplying systems. You're going to want to bring them together somehow. So I do think we're going in that direction. That will have unintended consequences. It will provide authentication mechanisms for saying like, okay, well, I take responsibility for this and that. And that opens up a whole, Pandora's box of its own, which is that, okay, well, great. Now we've got a single identifier around which you can coalesce all sorts of stuff. And that's what's happening in India. So I do think we're heading in that direction. I don't think, and it may offer something positive with regard to the authentication, but it also offers a lot of dangers because you're effectively supercharging the idea that our individual identities are going to take on coalesce and take on this enormous importance, such that we are effectively carrying around our digital shadow selves from the day we're born, and it's increasingly one shadow self that just is our reflection that we're stuck with. Although this is something I keep meaning to write about, although it's more soft speculative, which is that I do think that, in the same way that we've seen the explosion of genders over the last 20 years or so, I don't see why there's going to be any, I think people will start claiming to have, multiple selves too. So that, why can't I be two people? I think that's going to catch on at some point in the next decade or two. That's my prediction.
Well, in terms of where we are going in the future and, as we kind of come to a close here in the conversation, what are some of the solutions and ideas that you have around how we handle the problems of the meganets? And specifically, maybe you can speak to your thoughts on regulation and how much of a role that should play.
I mean, there's different types of regulations. If the EU forces Apple to use USB instead of Lightning, I'm on board with that. I'm really sick of Lightning cables. Okay, so I'm okay with that. Requiring standardization that way. If you're talking about auditing AIs and acting as some sort of registry for those things, that's, I think, a lot more of a non-starter, because there's this assumption that going in that the companies know what they're doing and they're just motivated in the wrong direction by profit incentives. And I'm not saying that's not a factor, but most of the things people are complaining about, when Facebook got in trouble for its Swedish neo-Nazi content, I really don't think there was anyone saying but we're making so much money off of it. It's just hard for me to see, Yeah, they would love to get rid of that stuff. They don't, but it's just so. If anything, I think a regulatory apparatus could easily act as effectively a sort of fig leaf for them to say not our problem. We let them look into it. And I don't see much in the way of government. Are you going to put the equivalent of you know, allow all cookies on these AIs. I mean, that's what I see. Yeah. So it's like,
is there a tangible solution that you do see though? Like, is there something that you would love to push people towards?
Their approaches, and there is room for even government participation in it. It doesn't quite fall under regulation so much as partnership. And again, it's things like, basically, it's just throwing spanners into the works of these systems and slowing them down, balancing out the ability for content to go viral by basically, instead of reinforcing virally exploding content, looking for a kind of seeking a gentler homeostasis. There's a number of directions you could go in. Having some kind of turn-taking mechanism to balance out the fact that the loudest people in various discussion spaces are often the ones that you that should be the quietest. That there are ways to do that, but generally non-targeted approaches in which you aren't trying to filter on content. That I think is the important thing, both for civil liberties concerns, and also because I think it's also just like not practically feasible. It amazes me when people seem to think that we could just like get rid of the bad data. A, because it would be because just identifying it is difficult, and B, because a lot of people seem to think that, well, everybody agrees with me on what bad is, and it never ceases to amaze me. As like, have you? You really think? I mean, there is some data. You know, there's a small amount of data that you could get like 95% consensus that, like, say, everybody should know about this. Oh, major earthquake. Okay, hopefully there's a consensus about that. Maybe not about anything about like what should be done about it, but at least maybe you can get, you know, we can at least report that happened. But beyond that, man, you know, didn't you see what happened with COVID? Like, there was so much. And no one shifted too. You had like there's a significant part of the population that differed from the so-called mainstream narrative and never changed.
They hid behind their bunkers, their narrative bunkers.
But in general, my suggestions, and I get into these in the last chapter of the book, my solutions orient around non-targeted ways of breaking up ossified groups, slowing down virality, slowing down the networks more generally, and also where possible, actually lowering faith in sort of just like random third-party data streams, so that you can't just sort of assume that, oh, this marketing data I bought from such and such a company is actually accurate. But I think there needs to be some experimentation there and some discussion, and a big point of the book was to just get that conversation started instead of people banging their heads against a wall that I don't think is going to really help us with anything.
Well, speaking of conversation starters, we'll come to the conversation closers here. Do you have any final thoughts, David? Anything you want to leave our listeners with that we haven't touched on that you might want to leave as a parting gift?
Well, since it's a Singularity podcast, I genuinely do think that the sheer scale we're at is actually going to lead us to new forms of, I think, of human organization and larger scale cognition. The difficulty, I think, is that individual rationality doesn't have as large a role to play as it did in the past. That I don't think it's guaranteed that when you put a lot of individual rationalities together, what you get out of it is a single rationality. You get something else. And you get something that that an individual may not even be capable of understanding. So again, to repeat what I said earlier, I think the unit of agency is going up. And if we actually want to get any grasp on what's going on, it's worth looking at how these individual organisms coordinate together and how they tend to act as unities. And I think that's a big challenge, but I think that that's actually where you're going to get more understanding than you are from trying to solve the alignment problem or what have you.